Welcome back to Livable Launch, the podcast where we explore the forefront of real estate development and innovation. I'm your host, Matthew Slutsky, and today we have a fascinating topic on our hands. We're diving into the launch of 101 Spadina and dissecting the current state of the new construction real estate market. Joining us is Puyan Sefapur, president and co-founder of Devron Developments, to discuss the often criticized system of selling on a promise rather than product. We explore what this means for everyone involved, from the developers to buyers, and how it impacts the integrity and future of real estate transactions. Stay tuned as we unravel these complex challenges and look for solutions in our conversation. It's an episode packed with insights you definitely don't want to miss. Puyan, great to have you on the show today. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
You are right now in the middle of a massive launch at 101 Spadina, but you guys have been around for a long time. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the history of Devron, where it came from, and where you're going with it?
Okay, big question. Basically asking, what do we do? Why do we do it? How did it start? So to answer it, I obviously will have to go kind of take a step back to the beginning. Generally speaking, I grew up around real estate as a kid. My father's an architect. My mother's an interior designer. I found myself eventually going and studying structural engineering. My brother went and studied architecture. My parents have been basically in the business of designing, building, homes, all sorts of real estate, really. Actually, they've done everything from institutional to commercial to universities to when we actually migrated to Canada, designing and building custom homes. So one of the answers to those questions is just having been kind of grown up around real estate. But I guess more speaking in these past like 20, 30 years, my father and my mom started a business designing, building custom homes. They built about 120 custom homes. A lot of it in that kind of North York area where we've grown up in Toronto. So that was kind of the precursor. Obviously, 30 years ago, I wasn't doing that much 30 years ago by way of work. But as we kind of came up with my brother and I, we sort of fell into the natural progression of going from single family to multifamily, basically building condos. And we started our first project back in 2011. It was a little project called Flow Condos, 12 story building. And that was sort of our first exercise, and we just basically winged it as a first project. We had our first performa was like a handwritten 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. We're trying to figure out with very loose and limited advice at that time, trying to figure out how to do a project basically. And luckily we made it through and the project actually did okay. But the reason why I bring up that project is that it became obviously a really good learning experience for us to have to do at that point. We barely had any team or employees. So my brother and I basically rolled up our sleeve and did everything from, obviously going from acquisition to zoning, to taking a project all the way through sales and marketing, customer service. So we kind of did the full spectrum kind of with our sleeves rolled up, and it made us understand and appreciate the challenges of putting up a building. But the most important thing it highlighted for us was kind of how broken the industry is. And when I say that, what I mean is, we sort of did, at that point, we're doing our first project. We took the best advice to follow the playbook of building condos in Toronto, which is, design a glass box and try and put as efficient, quote unquote, which means as small as possible, suites, and just run to brokers and ask them for their advice and run pricing and how to launch it and try and sell it. And then from the moment that you've sold it, you've locked your revenue, now try and build that building as efficiently, again, quote unquote, as possible, and finish the project, move on to the next one, rinse and repeat. As a naive at that point, still 20 something year old, kind of felt this can't this can't be it. this can't be how we build homes. And this is not how I think we build multifamily homes anywhere else in the world. This is a very, we have this very unique situation, and I would say kind of problem or opportunity in Toronto. So, you know, everywhere else in the world, the attitudes and opinions towards multifamily living and single family living are not so wildly separated. In Toronto, the word home for now in most people's mind is a house, and then there's condos, and there's this big gap and this divide between people's perception of what condos really are. So we've been, I think, for a whole bunch of different reasons, and I can go on for quite a bit to answer this, just this question, but there's a whole bunch of different reasons why we are where we are. But it just became apparent to us after just doing one project that it felt very unsatisfying knowing and feeling and hearing anecdotes about how basically the average person in the city doesn't love condos. The word condos doesn't inspire a feeling of aspiration and happiness and excitement and pride. Whether as a neighbor, when there's a condo coming up, whether as a person, you know, living in a condo, the word has not become synonymous with something that people really love, basically. So, and we just decided we can't, this can't be it. So that's really, I would say, actually the inception of who we are as a company and what we stand for, what we try to do, really started essentially from our second project and forward.
It's really funny because you only mentioned flow there as your first one, but as you were saying that, I feel like my mind like exploded having just walked through your sales center, which is beautiful for 101 Spadina. I can kind of see everything coming together from what you just said, from your brother being an architect to you structural engineering to your thinking about the layouts differently. Like, I feel like your years of experience have all kind of come together into 101 because it is a really unique project for the city from an architectural standpoint. You know, it's not just a glass box. And I think we're going to get into a lot of this later about the kind of smaller details about the project. But you literally can just see how you've kind of made it to this pinnacle in launching this project. And it is stunning. I do want to hear a bit about your other projects as well as what you currently have inventory. But again, talking about your previous projects coming into 101, is there like a thesis around Devron on where you buy sites, what you look for? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, you know, segueing from that, the prequel essentially of us kind of finding our mission and purpose. So basically, we highlighted that we have a problem. We have an amazing city that we genuinely have a lot of love for. I love Toronto. I feel like, you know, I love Toronto so much that even though I love vacation, whenever we go on vacation, I start to notice it, all the different ways that Toronto is just a better place. And I miss Toronto very quickly, basically. So I really love Toronto. So I want a lot of good things for it. And I think it has a lot of good things going for it. And I see Toronto as like as a teenager, basically. It's got a lot of potential, and most of its future is still undecided, basically. And when it comes to housing, I feel like we've been on a wrong path. We've been on a bad path. We have this amazing city. Lots of people from across the world are coming here. And we know that basically already at this point, the best solution, the most sustainable, and I don't mean just environmentally, overall sustainable solution for housing is living and basically in multifamily. Yet we have, you know, one of the worst, again, perceptions of living multifamily. So it's like we have people who want to come here and want to live here, but the main form of housing we're creating, they don't want to live in. And the reason is because we're not creating the right kind of multifamily housing for them. So that became kind of our purpose and passion of how do we build multifamily homes such that they are loved and they're appreciated and they're lived in long term and by people basically the same way they think about any kind of home. So that's became our passion. And that's, to answer your question, all the way from yes. So you asked a really good question. And it's like, where do you even fight? How do you even kind of select sites? You know, sometimes, you know, we see people, see developers look for sites and say, okay, well, as long as there's transit, that's a good site. As long as it, you know, this is the dollar per square foot for the site and there's transit, you know, we have a viable site. But from our perspective, I don't think that's how people choose homes, right? If you're choosing a neighborhood to live in, you care about transit. Absolutely. Transit's super important, but you also care about where's the closest grocery store. You also care about where are there parks, where are the schools, what are the schools like? You care about, what does it feel to walk home every day? Does it feel safe at night? Those, do you think about like a multitude of types of, you know, quote unquote infrastructure to think about whether that place is like a place that's a really good place to live long-term and for not just one segment of demographic, for everyone. So that's the way we look for sites. We look for sites in for all these layers of basic livability. Which is hard because, you know, when you overlap transit and, you know, the texture and culture and character of that neighborhood and schools and parks and, you know, you start to get narrower kind of pockets of space in the city. So we're a lot more selective as a result, and we end up limiting ourselves. But then it allows us to really create, when we really create a project, we're not just creating a condo or a project, we're creating homes, and we can really wholeheartedly create a building outside and inside that we know people are going to love, including the neighborhood as well as the actual home itself.
How much of what you were talking about, that issue of creating homes for people that people are not excited for, that's not really what they want, how much of that is really the fault of the builder versus how much of it is the fault of it's a systemic problem with the way the banking system runs and with the way the government runs, where you have to sell a certain amount of pre-sale. So you have to do that. And then to actually build these projects take like 10 years now. So someone who's buying, they don't know what 10 years holds. It creates an investor purchaser rather than an end user. So how much of it is the builder being like, let's just build quick and build these little boxes versus like, that's kind of what you have to build. And how are you getting away from that? Because you're not doing that. You're pushing against it, which has to be really difficult.
By the way, for obviously no one can see our faces. I was smiling and nodding the whole time Matt was asking those questions. Okay, yes. Whenever you have a large systemic problem, it is not the fault of any one player. It's a system. When it's a systemic problem, the root is not, again, born by one person. So what we have right now, the reason why we have this unique problem is because we have a unique setup in how we sell condos. So, you know, some years ago, whatever, 40, 50 years ago, where there were no condos in Toronto really, and it wasn't a thing to build condos, the banks were conservative, which totally made sense, and said, you know what, developers, if you want to build buildings, just go ahead and sell most of it first so we can make sure there's actually a market for these things, and then we'll lend you the money to build. Made lots of sense for, as a beta test, basically, for a new kind of housing form in Canada. It made a lot of sense to do that. But the problem is we never evolved that criteria, that beta testing. We became kind of the full rollout for the past, you know, 30, 40 years, and particularly these last 20 years when we had our boom, where it's no longer a question whether condos are a thing and people actually will live in them and people will buy them, but yet we're still pre-selling them. And that's the beginning of all of our problems, to be honest. So think about everything else that you buy that's any kind of product. You buy a phone, you buy a car. You get to go see and touch that phone and car. You get to test drive that car. You get to read 100 reviews on that car. So you know exactly what you're buying before you pay any money to get that product. So then that's totally normal, right? And then therefore the amount of money that you're willing to pay corresponds to the quality of the whatever someone's created for you. Now, unfortunately with condos, it's like the opposite. It's flipped upside down. You go and you buy, in a pre-construction world, you go and buy a promise. You go buy nice renderings and, you know, descriptions that are always amazing. There's probably been very few buildings that have never had ugly renderings. Like they're all going to be nice buildings apparently on paper, but that's what people buy. But then in reality, 4 years, 5 years later, you know, we've done actual studies that, you know, basically 90% of people feel that condos are built cheaply. So that's the gap we've ended up with because of this setup. And so, yes, just like you said, the problem is, you know, now flipping, you know, let's say put yourself in the shoes of what happens on the development side. Developers, you know, sometimes even start with good intentions of really actually they meant to build those renderings and those prompts exactly as they promised. And now the revenue is locked. So the revenue is not moving anymore. And now for the next 4 years, as they're building, there's no longer an incentive to build a high quality product anymore. Every incentive, that the flow of incentive at that point is to try and value engineer and, you know, to try and get in and out as soon as possible, because there's no longer a revenue incentive. That's the biggest problem. If today basically the system just said, you know what, we're going to let everybody, we're going to fund finance projects first, and when it's completed, they're going to sell. Every single developer would, their calculus would change immediately, because now, just like the producer of watches and phones and everything else, even if their goal is to make as much money as possible, it's not, you know, not out of charity. They want to make as much money as possible, but now they're going to create something that has as much quality as possible compared to its cost. Just like every other product. And now all of a sudden we would end up with a very different mix of suites. We would end up with much different architecture, much different quality of finishes inside, because they would be incentivized to. That's the problem. We have a huge feedback loop break between the actual user of the product and the creator of the product.
It's a broken system.
It is completely broken, and it is very hard to circumvent. And to your question of how are we doing it, it starts with a lot of desire to want to create actually kind of good quality homes. But there is business sense into it, in it as well too. We did an event at Massey Hall where we kind of talked about this topic, and whoever I speak to, I'm very open about sharing, you know, all of our learnings, or if you want to call it the blueprint of how to basically how to circumvent this problem that we have, because there's a really good business case for it, and it starts like this. So if you take basically a typical 40-story building, the average size of suites are, let's say, 600 square feet. And if you take that same envelope, that would be like a typical kind of project. Now, if you take the same building envelope and you divide it into, let's say, 750 square feet on average suite, so larger suites on average by 150 square feet, now you end up with like something about 113 less suites in that building.
A lot less kitchens to build.
Exactly. So what you end up, there's multitude of savings. So one is that you have 113 less suites of kitchens, washrooms, electrical, mechanical, drywall. And so you end up like in that same envelope, it's about $14, $15 million of savings in construction costs because of having less quantity of suites. And then you also end up having, by 113 less suites, you save about $7 million in development charges. Because development charges are also per unit based too. And that's, you know, that's based on today's development charges. Unfortunately, that number will continue to climb. So you add those two numbers up, you have something in the range of like $25 million of savings that you can now reinvest back into basically the, sometimes when I explain that business plan, the first thing goes to people's minds, like, great, we can do the same project and make $25 million more money. That's not how it works. So you have to, because in order to basically attract people who want to live in larger suites and in a better building, you now have to reinvest that $25 million, or at least, you know, most of it, back into a better architecture. Again, not a glass facade, and not just the typical kitchens, and not the typical finishes. So now you, not just the, you know, the typical elevators, you can upgrade all of the quality and aesthetic aspects that you know are usually the shortfall of the condos. So you can end up with basically a completely different and much higher quality building with larger average suites, but actually be at the same dollar per square foot as another typical building. Actually, in some cases, you know, you can even be lower on a dollar per square foot, because if you don't reinvest all the $25 million, you can use some of that to actually reduce your purchase price point. So sometimes, actually, again, people see a project like Spadina and say, how are you at this dollar per square foot, which is the same dollar per square foot as another mid-market project in a glass building? And this is how we can basically, it ends up being basically a win-win for everybody. Win-win for the consumer because they're paying the same dollar per square foot, but getting a totally different product. And you know, it's a win-win for us because we feel like we're actually building better buildings. And there's a whole bunch of so many benefits of selling basically to end users too. For example, we just closed a project called the Winslow, which is registered and closed. And in an environment where a lot of people worried about closing out projects, we had no issues or no stress closing a project because we had real people, real end users, and they were looking forward to living in those homes, and they closed. And it's just one of the small benefits of really dealing with real people.
Moving to 101 Spadina for a sec. I mean, the first question I wanted to ask you is why launch now? But it kind of also plays into what you were just talking about, where you've done an exceptional job. This building is exceptional, and it does seem to have a bit larger suites, kind of everything you were just talking about. Is that because of the market conditions where investors aren't so heavy right now? Or is that, what have you built the same way in any market? Or was this kind of planned for this launch?
It's a really good question. So we would be building and leading into our purpose regardless of the market. But before I actually answer the rest of that question, I do want to, there's one thing I want to dispel. I think another challenge, I don't want to call it a myth or misconception in our industry. The word end user, like, so for the actual, people who are listening to this and hear the word end user, we're talking about, the homeowner, essentially. Some people say, what's an end user? In the industry, we talk about end users as like the actual person occupying and living in the building. And then, a lot of debate is had about, actually, unfortunately, very little debate sometimes is had whether to focus a project on end users or focus on investors, which I think is like flawed from so many different perspectives. First of all, imagine any other industry other than ours where they said, we're going to design these cars. Should we design them for the end user of the car or should we design them for investors? Can you imagine how wild of a question that would be? Like everyone sitting around that boardroom would be like, what are you talking about? Or a phone or whatever it is. Like there's no other product or service where we sit down and debate whether to cater that product or service to the end user. It's like business 101, that any business that's very good at understanding its end user and catering a product or service to it, that business succeeds and vice versa. So this is like one of those red flags. Like the fact that we're having these conversations or having these debates, even for a short period of time, having those debates is a very, very big problem, because most of the time it's not a debate. It's like, no, it needs to be an investor building. There's very few times where people say in this industry, let's do an end user project. The word end user actually usually strikes fear in the hearts of developers for the most part. They feel like it comes with all sorts of like challenges.
But this also comes back to the systemic issue with the current industry where those discussions are being had. And whether you're an end user being someone who's actually buying it to live in versus an investor who's buying it to rent it out, the end product should be the same. Like
100%.
If you're renting, does that mean you have to have a smaller place? Like
100%.
It doesn't make sense.
So that's the myth I want to dispel, is that there's no difference between the objectives of an end user and investor. Or maybe said no, there shouldn't be a difference between the objective of an investor and an end user. Because got to keep stepping out of this industry because there's just so many mental confines that we're stuck with. If you were looking at investing in a business, wouldn't you want to invest in a business that they are creating let's say Apple of, some years ago, where they really were focused on the user. Would have been a very good investment because that product is going to be really desired and loved by the user and therefore becomes a good investment. And vice versa, would you want to invest in a business that really does not cater to its user? Would that be a good investment? Because in the end, you invested in that product. In the end, you're going to have to, in the case of a condo, you're going to have to either lease or sell that condo to an end user. So why should... It's very, very misinformed and misled way of thinking to be thinking that the goals of an investment in buying a condo should be different than the goals of an end user. If anything, if you're investing in buying a condo, you need to care more even than the developer about the end user. Because what's happening is that you are actually buying something that, and how much it's desired by the end user is going to determine whether you had a good investment or not.
How much of your kind of thought and philosophy on this comes from your family's background in low rise? Because you mentioned your parents were single family home builders, and these types of discussions that we're having about these investors or end users doesn't really happen in the custom home building industry or so much in the low rise portion of the world. Do you feel like your kind of thoughts on this came from that upbringing of you're actually just building a house, you're not building this other thing?
You know, there may be some influence. I'm sure there's some influence there, but actually most of it, you know, comes from just my own, you know, I grew up for a number of different reasons, feeling kind of, you know, how do I phrase this? I grew up with a sense of fear of irrelevance. Meaning, like, you know, one of the anxieties I had as a teenager growing up, or even probably as an earlier kid, thinking like, what's my point and purpose in life? And then the fear of living a life where like I'm irrelevant and what I'm doing doesn't matter, you know, made it kind of difficult to accept my mortality, basically. So this goes a little bit deeper. It goes from a sense of this purpose comes from a sense of wanting to make sure what I spend my life's energy on, and therefore, you know, such a big part of our life is spent with our career. What I spend that life energy on is spent doing something that is making the world somehow better than where I found it, basically. So that's where all this comes from. As I said, it started with, I didn't really, when we got into building condos, I didn't really, didn't know how I was going to have an impact on it. But when I start to realize how broken it was and how bad of a path we're headed on, is a reason we're just passionate about. I became very, very focused on how do we fix it? How can I have an impact on this industry to steer things in the right direction? Because if we can make people love housing, the main form of housing we're building in the city, has a huge impact on the way the city feels and develops. So that's honestly that's where more of this comes from. It's a bit of a journey to want to make sure we you know, we don't just spend a career focus on just making money, because, you know, if you speak to anyone at the end of their life or the end of their career, no one's reflecting on how much money they made or what their ROI points were. They start to reflect back on what impact did you have on the people and on the world around you.
I love that. So jumping into the building itself, first of all, you've got a beautiful model suite here, which again I love seeing, because I think the model suite kind of disappeared for a bit, especially on the high rise side. So, I mean, beautiful model suite. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the building itself from a unit perspective? Like how many one bedrooms, two bedrooms, what's the size range and kind of average price per square foot for anybody's interested?
Yeah, actually, you know, if you don't mind, I'm just going to, I just realized I didn't actually answer your question of why launch now.
Oh yeah.
I'll answer that really quickly, but basically everything for all the reasons that I just mentioned, we actually really purposely wanted to launch this project at a time right now where it's much quieter. There isn't a lot of other projects launching at the moment. There's a lot
I
of
I think you're the only one launching.
that are sidelined because of what's going on in the market. And we really, really wanted to show when everyone is kind of hopefully noticing, paying attention, asking questions, that you can take this approach of building a higher quality building, focus on end users, regardless of the kind of economic kind of cycle or market cycle you're in. You know, because if the market was like so busy right now, it's like 30 different projects happening, this project would have come by and no matter how it would have done well or whatever, no one would have noticed and no one maybe would have cared. So we thought this is a really good opportunity to especially given the location, how kind of central it is too. It's an opportunity to really have an impact on the way, hopefully, Give people another option to approach basically doing development. That's really kind of the main reason we did it. Because yes, when we were gearing up for it, there's, you know, our sales team member thinking why launch now? If we wait another 6 months to a year, we can sell much more and faster. Why put ourselves through doing it now? And really genuinely, this was the reason. I think there's a big opportunity to We're at this like inflection point as an industry because we've been, it's like a moment of reflection, you know, like happens in your life sometimes when you have a, you hit a rough patch in your life, or you know, you get fired, something happens in your life, but it makes you stop on your tracks. Those are the times where we have a chance to change our habits or change kind of direction we go in our life. And I think that's, as an industry, that's what's happening right now. And we're hoping we can kind of be a catalyst as a result.
Yeah, you can see it. I mean, I wasn't at the Benjamin Talon Alley Wolf event at Massey Hall that you mentioned, although I heard it was amazing. So I didn't get to hear about the kind of economics of what led you to launch. But I've been by now, you know, two times over the last few weekends, over the weekend, and it's been like a lineup out the door. Like it's been, again, I know that builders hold their sales numbers very close to their hearts, but it looks like it is booming. I mean, it's amazing to see, and so great for the industry to see that happening.
Appreciate it. Yeah, no, we've had a good start to sales. And while obviously, you know, compared to a couple of years before, or maybe a year from now, you know, people will need more time to make decisions to make sure they're making the right financial decision. But everyone, you know, I can genuinely kind of say this without too much of a fear of sounding like I'm patting ourselves on the back, but really everyone who's seen the project and comes seeing what it's about, what the story is, what the details are behind the building, everyone does seem to really respond positively and be excited for it. So it's been we've had a really good start to sales this past few weeks. To answer your question of what the building is made up, I mean, you know, a lot of condo projects are really focused on just the smaller suites and focused on kind of first-time home buyers or renters through suites that are owned by investors, and that's a spectrum that obviously needs housing for sure. But you know, it's 90% plus of our condos have been focused on this one narrow spectrum. So One-on-One Spadana, just like a lot of other projects, we, you know, yes, there are smaller suites as well for first-time home buyers, but there also are, you know, suites that are in 700 square feet. A lot of units in the 700 to 900 square foot range, you know, providing two bedrooms, two bedrooms plus den for people who have young kids, people who have older kids, people who are, you know, on the cusp of kind of being downsizers, and people who are downsizers. There are suites all the way, I mean, really, they get up to kind of the average of over 2,000 square feet above the building, on the top, near the top of the building too. So there's quite a mix. There's it's like a little community, basically. The same way I think most neighborhoods should be and are. You know, you don't have like you don't have this like whole neighborhood of just downsizers or just basically you know, first-time buyers. So there really is quite a bit of a spectrum. As a result, compared to most buildings, the average size of suites are much larger. There's a much bigger focus on having suites that are livable long-term.
You also have some amazing amenities in the building. You know, we're in the sales center right now. So in our tour of the sales center before we started taping, you know, it has an amazing looking kids room. It has the rooftop terrace. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the amenity structure in the building?
Yeah. And so we took the same approach of thinking longer term, thinking about all spectrums of people when we came up with the amenities. So like you mentioned, there's a children's playing room. We've done that in past buildings as well too. There is, we have three different, very different kind of party rooms, you know, if that's the term we call it, or congregating rooms where you can do dining or lounging, but just having variety, again, for different structures and different kinds of hangouts. We have kind of a, I would say a co-work area where you can do work along with other people. And what's kind of cool about that space, it lives under the arches in the base of the building, overlooking a park, which is a whole other kind of interesting feature in the building. A lot of these amenities, I think, are best seen more than described, because it's the combination of, it's just as much what they look like and how they feel than what they are. Because there's a really nice gym, but you got to see the gym rather than kind of describe it. What's kind of neat, though, maybe even description wise, you can, you know, that's some justice, is at the top of the building, kind of nestled under these really tall double height arches, we have an interior lounge that's one of those like three party rooms. That it's a really cool space that you can kind of overlook the whole city. And it's connected to two different outdoor terraces. One is more kind of a dining, one's more of a lounge and seating. But you can also then walk around, for anyone who's seen the building, the top of the building are basically this colonnade of arches. And so you can actually walk underneath this colonnade of arches that they kind of light up at nighttime like a lantern too. You can walk 360 degrees all around kind of this top of the building and essentially kind of get a 360 view of the whole city. So those are the cool things about amenity. And the park itself is another amenity.
I was going to say, I think, you know, the arches on the top, I think speaks a lot to the, you know, we talked about your background on the structural side and your brothers on the architectural side. I mean, that's like going to be an icon. But I actually thought the most interesting was the building set back from Adelaide with a park in front, which I you know, you don't see that. I mean, very rarely. I remember there's a Brad Lamb project on King, I think, that's set back with a little park in front, but so rare to see that.
Yeah, that's a culmination of a whole bunch of sweat and tears over the past 8 years of working through a partnership with the City of Toronto, essentially, where we, you know, we had our site and the City of Toronto had their sites around us, and we kind of combined it to create this building and this division where we have the building itself, and then we have a 10,000 square foot park, like you said, on the north side. So the corner of Adelaide and Spadina is actually going to be a new 10,000 square foot public park, which is really cool because your main front entrance onto the lobby, you enter in or you exit through a park, which is just really cool. It's not something you usually have, essentially like a front yard.
And a lot of the amenity spaces are overlook this.
That's park. Right. Yeah. So a lot of the amenity spaces are on the second floor and kind of again nestled on a series of arches actually overlook the park, which is pretty cool. So that's another obviously major amenity. Aside from like all the aesthetic and the suites and, you know, we're talking about like Miele appliances, like there's a lot of those types of more obvious visual things that we put into the quality of the building. But there's a whole bunch of things that we refer to as like building sciences, which we do in all our projects to address the less maybe exciting, but actually more important quality features in a building. So
I think one of them is the most exciting. I think the geothermal is incredible. But
So geothermal is one of them. Because that one may be a little longer, I'll just mention quickly some of the other ones. Some of the common pain points living in a building in condos is long elevator times. One of the main gripes is like hearing your neighbors a lot, smelling your neighbors' foods. Leaks that can happen. Everyone's kind of seen at some point an article with a unintended external waterfall feature of a building, dripping down. So these are a lot of the kind of common pain points in buildings, which in all our buildings we address, and we try to make them better and better each building that goes by. So for example, we have a much higher ratio of elevators. We have four elevators for only 300 and something suites. But more importantly, you know, we've kind of reinforced the structure around the elevators to allow us to provide very high speed elevators that about 20% faster than the average elevator.
I've always said I think there should be like a metric that purchasers look at, like the elevator to unit ratio, which no one ever thinks about when it's they're purchasing. True. But so many people get by these places and get stuck waiting at lobby elevator. Because the builder's not putting in the fastest elevator or not putting enough elevators.
It's true. You know, it's actually kind of scary that there's no building code requirement for, like, you, if you really wanted to, you could put a 900 unit building and just put two elevators in there. And it's sad to say that there isn't. It's left up to the discretion of development. And back to the whole problem, because everything's sold on spec. The unsuspecting buyer as an investor or a homeowner doesn't really know to ask that question. But if they were touring that building in real life and they realize it takes, you know, 3 minutes to get an elevator, you know, that would have mattered, which is again back to the whole problem that we have of selling on promise rather than selling a product. So there's that. There's, you know, we have leak detection and shut off systems throughout the building. So as soon as the leak happens, not only is it detected and notifies management, but more importantly, it actually shuts it off at the source. Because we all know that by the time a leak is detected, and by the time you get someone to get in there, the damage is basically done. So, you know, it's a lot like acoustics. Again, putting better acoustic between suites so you can't hear your neighbors behind you, beside you as much, and having underlay acoustic layer below the flooring kind of reduce some of that sound impact. Drawing fresh air directly from the outside of the suite rather than through the corridors, you know, giving people real fresh air. Sealing the doors below the doors so you don't hear the sounds and again the smells coming from the corridor. It's a whole bunch of things like that. And we have a section in our which you obviously saw in our sales office to try and explain all these bailing features. But these things really matter. These are things that again, if you were buying a building when it was really fully complete, a lot of these things you would experience and then you would appreciate. But unfortunately, that's why they're not usually done, and that's why these gripes exist in living condos.
Yeah, and coming back to that main issue, it's also the importance of buying from a great builder with a great track record. Like, you know, someone listening to this now knows when they're buying a Devron, they know that the progression of building better and better and better every time versus a builder who is building one building and they owned a parking lot and decided they're a builder. And I always say, you know, you get those one-time builders, the purchasers are getting taxed on them being a first-time builder. Like, you're paying this unknown tax for the future of just the building is not going to be built that well.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And actually, I've said this, you know, to a lot of people, friends or family, they ask me for advice on buying pre-construction condos. And the first thing I tell them is that, you know, whoever that builder is, go and see their most recently completed project. And that's really the most important thing. Like everything else you've been shown and promised matters much less than if you go and see what their actual past completed projects really look and feel like, because a lot of those things are going to be similar to what you can expect, good or bad, basically. So yeah, you're right, that's the problem, not realizing what you're getting. And you really, I think there was a time where people didn't pay enough attention to what they were buying, where they were buying, who's building it, and didn't ask enough questions. And I think the more educated and the more demanding buyers become as investors or end users, like I said, they really have the same incentive. They should have the same objective. If they ask more questions and become more discerning, hopefully it closes that feedback loop break a little bit between the builder and the consumer.
Do you want to tell me a little bit about the geothermal?
I forgot about that. Sorry. So geothermal. So, basically a system that provides heating and cooling year round, in simplest terms, using the earth as almost like a battery to exchange heating and cooling with, in effect, and it's a very efficient system, especially when it's combined with heat pumps and in a higher performing envelope. You know, one of the problems with the typical glass condo facade is, I mean, one is the way it looks and feels. It doesn't inspire a lot of emotion, I guess, and it doesn't age very well aesthetically and quality wise. And the other problem with them is that they're really the worst envelope. They're the worst performing envelope for especially for such a, we have such a harsh climate. If we lived in Vancouver or California, we had like really mild temperature, it's one thing. But we have like the most extreme cold and the most extreme heat. So we really need good envelope. And that's one of the benefits of, you know, all of our buildings, we have basically solid facades, masonry, brick, precast. And so when you start with a good facade from a thermal performance perspective, and then you can put more efficient heat pumps in the system, then you combine that with geothermal, it becomes a really good efficient system of heating and cooling. And the cool thing about it is that basically, in year one, the cost of heating and cooling is like similar to basically a conventional system. But then every year that passes with the volatility in energy prices, this stays consistent. Basically, geothermal heating cooling stays consistent. So you end up having, you hedge basically your heating and cooling costs to against basically the, you know, what's happening in the rest of the world with energy. And then, when the system is fully then owned, then at that point becomes even more substantial kind of benefit, because now the building owns a geothermal system. And there's, you know, aside from kind of maintenance, there's no more actually kind of heating and cooling, there's no significant heating and cooling costs. So it's like basically short, immediate terms, it's, you're at a, you're on par with a conventional system, and each year that goes by, it gets better and better, and then you get to ownership, full ownership, and then it's a huge step, basically, benefit compared to a conventional system. So, and in addition to the fact that obviously it's a renewable source, so it's a, you know, you have from an environmental perspective, you have a renewable source rather than kind of using gas.
I love it. One more question to ask you, because I think you have a really unique take on balconies. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on balconies, because again, I know I've always had my own thoughts on balconies, but you just walked me through the model suite. And I think there's just such an interesting argument for the way that you do the Juliet balconies. Actually, I don't know if they're called Juliet balconies,
yeah, but that's right,
the balcony style. So can you tell us a little bit about your philosophy around balconies?
Sure. Yeah. So we've, you know, even... our philosophy on balconies starts with, like, again, another one of these, we do a lot of things at some point, and because somebody does it, it becomes a thing to do, and then we all just follow without question again. I think balconies is another one of those things. Again, based on the climate that we have a whole bunch of the year is either too hot or too cold, and then we have this, like, very narrow spectrums of time where the weather is actually nice to be outside. And as soon as it's nice to be outside, for the most part, if we have a choice, if we're not working, we're actually getting out of our homes. So as a result, there are stats basically on how the average, like, Toronto balcony gets used like less than 2% of the time. So, okay, so you have a space that we, let's say, like the idea of, I think what people really like and need is the ability to connect with the outdoors. I think that's a real need, and it's not like a, that's like almost like at a biological level, we kind of need to feel connected to the outside. So that part is true. But then we have this idea of using these balconies, which again, don't get used very much. But then what happens is that, you know, this is very easy to understand when you actually in our model suite, we can show you. But basically, you know, if you're standing in a space where you have a balcony and the unit above you has a balcony, and you're sitting in your living room and you're looking outside, the first thing you see at the bottom of your windows is a 5-foot, you know, concrete balcony, and what you see at the top of your window is another 5-foot concrete balcony, the lower one collecting dust and the top one, you know, acting almost like a baseball cap that you're wearing. And the effect of it is, A, not necessarily the nicest thing always to look at, you know, the balcony, this concrete balcony, but it takes up, it reduces the light and view into your unit by about 15%. So now your living space, your living dining space that's off of your windows is a space that you occupy 90% of the time. So now the space that you are in 90% of the time is compromised by light and view by 15% for a space that you might use 1-2% of the time. So it's like a very, when you put that into context, people, you start to realize that, okay, maybe this isn't the best way to connect to the outdoors. The other problem with it is these extruded concrete, cantilevers are also bringing the heat and cold from the outside into your unit. So they become a thermal bridge. So the space, you know, the space near your windows end up being the most uncomfortable. It's the best part of your suite, but it becomes the most uncomfortable part of your suite, because that's where you're getting the largest amount of transfer of, like, heat and cold, which you don't want from the outside. And then you got these vents on top of your head trying to counteract the heat and cold from the outside. So you have this, like, most extreme hot and cold situation and near your most valuable part of your suite. So that's another thing that sucks about balconies. So these are all the reasons that even in a project like we did at Winslow, where the average price of suites is over $4 million, for most of the suites, unless you basically had a terrace, for most of the suites, it's the same kind of Juliet balcony that we provide, where you either have a large opening slider or you have French, actually in the case of Spadina, we actually have French doors as well too, that, you know, swing open and you have that connection to the outdoor. So you can feel, you can be literally sitting on a chair right up to the railings as if you were on a balcony. So you get that sense of connection and big opening to the outdoor, but minus all of those, the view, the light, the heat and cold problems, and the visual aspect of concrete balconies.
From a view perspective, being in your model suite, you can instantly feel it. Like, you walk into your model suite and you get that sense that you're, like, right at the view level without any obstruction.
Not to mention, 100%, yeah. It's when we've had people who you know, they're in the front of the sales office, they're like, I must have a balcony. And we're like, okay, we get it. And then we walk to the model suite and, you know, essentially they see the visual of the space and we explain this to them and they're like, oh, I totally get it. Yeah, okay.
In addition to that, you're building a park out the front door.
Yeah.
And have a balcony with barbecues on the rooftop. Like there is the ability to have that without it being semi-private on your on
exactly outside. Exactly. And not to mention, by the way, that the other unfortunate effect of balconies is that they really don't do the architecture of the building any justice either. So, you know, if you take buildings and you put a wraparound concrete balcony, it is really hard to come up with you know, timeless architecture, that a building that people look from the outside and say, oh, it's a really nice looking building with those concrete balconies wrapped around it. It's a hard thing to do. So
I know I said that was my last question, but my real last question, someone who's listening is interested in one-on-one Spadina. I don't think you mentioned the price, the average, kind of the range of price per square foot and where's the sales center located? How do people get in touch?
Yeah, for sure. Sorry, I didn't mean to avoid your question. Because like I said, you have quite a spectrum of suites throughout the building. We have some suites that are smaller. We have some suites that have, anyways, there's quite a range. And so goes the dollar per square foot. Like we have suites as low as probably $1,300 per square foot. And we, you know, it also goes up as high as, you know, in the upper $2,000 per square foot. It all depends on the exposure, the size, the layout. So there's quite a bit of a range. We really try to kind of create the building so there's something for everybody. So the sales office is actually at Adelaide and Spadina as well too. So the site itself at 101 Spadina is the southeast corner. The presentation gallery is on a northwest corner underneath a really nice heritage building called the Tower Building. So the sales office is open from basically every day of the week except Fridays. And that's, I think, the best way to experience the building and see it is actually to come to the sales office for sure. And the website is simple as 101spadina.com. And usually whenever sort of someone visits our website, our team kind of immediately gets in touch with them to help them book their visit and come see and answer any questions they have.
And again, it's also worth coming to see the model suite. It's a beautiful model suite. The marble you use is so unique and appreciate awesome. It. So thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Thank you for tuning into Livable Launch, your go-to podcast for all things condo and new home launches. We hope today's episode has given you valuable insights into the exciting world of real estate development and the minds behind these remarkable projects. We're incredibly grateful to our esteemed guests and our dedicated listeners like you who continue to make this podcast a success. Remember, Livable Launch is here to keep you informed, inspired, and engaged with the ever-evolving landscape of condo and new home developments. We value your feedback and want to ensure that Livable Launch remains your trusted source of information. So don't hesitate to reach out. Remember, we're all in this exciting journey together. If you have any questions or suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear from you. Connect with us on our website or social media platforms. And if you're a builder industry expert who wants to share your expertise and be featured on our show, please get in touch. We'd love to hear about your latest project launches and insights. Thank you again for joining us on Livable Launch. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. Stay up to date with the latest condo and new home launches, trends, and insider knowledge. Until next time, keep building, dreaming, and exploring the world of real estate. Remember, Livable Launch is here to guide you for every step of the way. I'm Matthew Slutsky, and this is Livable Launch signing off. Happy building, and see you soon.